The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome to Film Weekly, I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, I meet Tandy Newton to discuss her role in the British thriller Retreat and her shift from screen to stage. Also, British director Lynn Ramsey joins me from Scotland to discuss her brilliant blood-red film adaptation of Lionel Shriver's harrowing bestseller, We Need to Talk About Kevin. And joining me to talk about films is Zan Brooks. We'll be reviewing Steven Soderbergh's Contagion, the Korean thriller The Yellow Sea, and the Black Power mixtape, a powerful tracing of the Black Power political movement through the late 60s to the early 70s. Yes, this podcast will not be televised. It's Film Weekly. From her debut in the Australian school indie film Flirting 20 years ago, Tandy Newton has starred in films such as Beloved and in the Oscar-winning Paul Haggis film Crash. Tandy is a Hollywood A-lister with blockbuster credits such as Mission Impossible 2 and The Chronicles of Riddick, but she also supports the British independent sector whenever she can, such as her latest role alongside Cillian Murphy and Jamie Bell in the British thriller Retreat, which we reviewed here on this show last week. But this week, Tandy is preparing to play Paulina in Death and the Maiden by Ariel Dorfman here in London's Harold Pinter Theatre. So I went along to meet her at the stage door. I'm sitting in the green room of the Comedy Theatre, or the Pinter Theatre, as it should be known now, and I'm joined by Miss Tandy Newton.
Hello, my darling.
How are you? You're going on the stage. Well, quite so. You're going to rehearse a bit now for Death and the Maid.
Yes, I am. We've started our previews and we've got our first night coming up on Monday, so this is crunch time. Mm-hmm. It's Tuesday. So what we've been doing is rehearsing all day. We do our preview in the evening, which has an audience, and we're basically performing the play. And then Jeremy Heron, the director, will give us notes the following morning, and then we work through the notes.
So when you go to these previews, which I used to do as a student, you think previews, oh, it can't be that much different to the final performance. When you get your notes, do you go away and tweak and try something out the next night?
Definitely. Every night. I mean, sometimes it's really dramatic, like he'll completely change the blocking of a scene. But it's exciting, and it makes me a lot less precious about, you know, getting everything perfect on the night. We're still exploring, and I think that we've got to keep that sense of freedom even when we're performing it after press night. I hope so, anyway.
That must be entirely different from what you're used to, because it's been a long time since you were on the London stage.
Never been
on the London stage. No. Have I been on the London stage more than you? From my National Youth Theatre days?
I think you have. To 18 years ago, I was in a performance of the Vagina Monologues where I just played one of the monologues on stage. Loved it. I love being on stage, mm-hmm. You know, and I've given talks or, you know, hosted things and been on stage. I'm very comfortable, but actually a full performance of a play, never done before.
Wow. So, I mean, how do you, because given that you've done so many films, really, if you think back 20 years, I don't want to remind you, but...
No, it's that long for me, too.
22 years.
Flirting was the first.
Yeah.
Lovely. And Retreat, which we'll talk about in a minute, is the latest. Out to the cinemas and on DVD shortly, DVD Blu-ray.
Is it?
Yes. Okay. The one I got was Blu-ray.
Oh, my God. So it's going to be out at the cinema and DVD at the same time?
Yeah, I know. Everything's
changed.
I know. Everything's changed. She says Flirting. Oh, my God. Tell that.
I remember Betamax.
Well, now you're going back to even further. This is kind of, you know, this is flexing the muscles of acting. So what are you doing different, or are you having to learn a whole new skill set? Because most of the time people are trained, and you didn't even, I mean, no offence, but you didn't really even
I trained as a dancer, absolutely, which has come into, it's useful up to a point, just in terms of, you know, when you're on stage, you really have to have physical charisma as well as, you know, the other side of the performance. But funnily enough, the 90 minutes of performing the play, now that we've got to the place where we're doing that and we've got a shape to it and I understand what I'm doing, that's bliss. It really is bliss. it's just the nirvana of acting, because you get to create the whole arc of the character. You have the audience right there, so that you sort of, you're infused with their energy as well. The thing that's been incredibly challenging has been the rehearsals, having to get to this point. And I've basically had to condense years of theatre training into the 4 weeks that I've also been rehearsing, you know, with the other actors for the play. Because it's a whole different skill set, yeah. You know, the voice projection, inhabiting the stage, an awareness of the audience, not blocking the other actors. It's very, very technical. And then once the technique is in place, then you can really do what I'm used to doing, which is being emotional, being spontaneous.
What have you been doing for voice training? Been booming around the house?
I go to Wormwood Scrubs with my dog. I just stand in the middle of it. Imagine that the prison inmates are my audience, and I friggin' give them a soliloquy. That's what I do.
Have any of them thrown anything out of their barred windows?
Oh, God. No, they haven't yet. But that's what I've been doing. I've been just, you know, it's more about intention, and it's about communication. And I think it's also just the common sense of when you're in a space like that and you know you're talking to people who are a good, you know, 100, 200 yards away from you up in the gods, it's just you've obviously got to project to be heard. Mm-hmm. And I think my dance training was useful in that respect, in that I know how to open up a performance to communicate, yeah. To
you have one of the finest necks on screen or on stage, Mess. I've always thought you're a great neck.
Well, thank you very much.
The being on stage, it's interesting, you're on the London stage for the first time, and you look around at all the pictures of all the theatres as one wanders through, and obviously there's some, you know, a gallery of famous people all at the same time. You do stand out as being the most blackface on those posters, which I think I didn't really notice it until I was actually walking here today.
The most or the only?
I think you're probably the only, yeah.
Right,
I don't want to denigrate someone who may be popping up somewhere, but you're certainly a lead. It's a casting that I didn't ever consider. That was odd casting, obviously, for the area. Yeah. But it is odd to see a blackface on the London stage, probably in the audience. Too.
And it's funny, actually, because it was never mentioned from when I was offered the role through rehearsals. It's never even occurred to me. The only thing I've thought is how fantastic that once again I'm in a role by virtue of being a successful actress, that has actually, my success has taken me out of being black or white or whatever into just being a talented performer. Mm. And I think that how terrific that is. But at the same time, we've got to get to the point where we're thinking about actors of all skin colour when we're casting roles, you know. And I find it endlessly frustrating when I can see roles that could have been played by any number of different, you know, racial, you know, different ethnicities. And I know damn well that they weren't even opened up to those.
Do you think the audiences respond to the casting of a black face or an Indian face? Would that ethnicity identify more with someone?
I think that people want to feel reflected. I think that they want to go and... I think theatre is such a visceral experience. You want to feel part of it. And you're more likely to if you can identify with the characters on stage, which is why, interestingly enough, since I've been doing these previews, there are many more black faces in the audience, which I'm so thrilled about, because they feel more able to relate to me, even though I'm like you or I'm like, you know, everybody else. But that's not the point. They feel able to relate. Mm. Because normally when I go to theatre, which I do often, I'm the only brother in the audience. And I just feel... Of course I question, like, how come? And is it economics? Is it, you know... And I think it's just, you don't relate. Whereas when I'm down in, you know, I go and see Panto every Christmas down in Brixton. And, no, not in Hackney City, yeah. Empire. Wonderful. And it's not just black, it's black, white, everybody's there. Yeah. Because they relate to the mixed ethnicity on the stage.
Do you think that... I mean, I've been in cinema audiences that it depends where you go, where if you go to Peckham or whatever, or even Holloway Road, somewhere like that, you get a large proportion of black audiences for whatever film it is. You were recently in All the Coloured Girls, a film which I really, actually, no one seemed to like, I really liked it. You had a great part in that.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
And that was clearly a coloured experience, if I'm allowed to call it
that
now.
Well,
yeah.
Have a go. Go on.
See what happens.
That must have attracted huge black audiences.
Well, funnily enough, Tyler Perry, who directed that film, is a phenomenon in the States. He hasn't crossed the pond. Bizarre to me. I didn't know who he was when he offered me his first movie, and this is quite a long time ago. And finally, we got to work together on For Coloured Girls. I had a tiny opening in this country, and all the people that have seen it, not all of them, but the ones that have communicated with me, just said, why? Why wasn't this everywhere in England? Yeah. Because black people who could very much relate to the movie felt really sort of were disappointed that this wasn't available for them. Yeah. And I think that the more people of colour you get on stage, the more people of colour you get in the cinema, the more people of colour are going to want to go, you know.
I'm assuming for your current film, Retreat, which we mentioned before, where you're Cillian Murphy's wife, things aren't going too well between the two of you. You go to a swept away cottage. I don't even know what the script would have said, but I presume it didn't specify what colour you were in that. And it was good to see that it's not even mentioned in the script at all.
Well, no, I mean, you know, Cillian and I are playing sort of the parsley chopping massive from Queen's Park, you know, and I live in Queen's Park, London, and, you know, it's a wonderfully varied, mixed...
Do you use parsley a lot?
Love my herbs, or my herbs, as I should say. And you know, that's my reality, is a multicultural, ethnic, you know. Hmm. So that's what we were reflecting.
And I suppose they sort of stuck out. Well, they would have stuck out if they'd gone to a sort of more populated island, but actually there was no one
there
at all.
There was no one else there, so it's like, that's what you get. There you go. Yeah, it's interesting.
It's a strong part for you, that one. I haven't seen you... I don't know if I'm wrong, but I've not seen you handle a weapon before, Ms. Newton.
I don't think I have, you know. No, I did. There's a movie which didn't come out here at the cinema, Vanishing on 7th Street.
Oh.
I was totally
vanished.
Down in that. Yeah, vanished, exactly. Yeah, but no, a lot of gun handling this last couple of years. Yeah. But interesting, what I'm glad about with the old gun handling of both The Retreat and this is that it's not sort of cartoon violence, pop violence, you know, and it's not a gun to look cool.
No,
or a gun to be... you know, to be powerful. Yeah. And
not like if you'd done it in Mission Impossible 2. I don't think you had a gun in that. Can't remember.
No, I hadn't.
Just
a bad driver. I think I had a syringe, which I then killed, had hurt myself with. No, but you know what I mean?
It's a kind of rickety old violence. Hunting rifle. Though.
Yeah, and it's not pop violence. That, you know, the weapons that I'm using, both in Retreat and God knows in Death and the Maiden, it's a gun for the purpose of what a gun is for. And I'm... You know, the play is about lots of things, and it's not about gun violence.
No, or gun porn in any way.
Yeah, although it is something which is very, very much part of our culture, this whole notion of, you know, gun, power, weapons, knives. And I'm glad that I'm not perpetuating, you know, that.
Is it just a coincidence, or is that something you would actually actively make a choice about before picking up the weapon?
What do you mean?
Well, if you saw a script that required, you know, perpetuation of gun violence as myth or whatever, or pornography, would you kind of say, you know, it's not for me, we're happier doing it when it's dramatically necessary, when it's a dramatic necessity?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a number of scripts that I've been offered where the violence I've felt is gratuitous, and so I won't either. I'll suggest that they lessen it. There have been two in previous years. And in both situations, they didn't want to. And I just thought it was pornography.
Mm-hmm. Are these bigger Hollywood films?
Not particularly, but they're, you know, American, big American movies where the baddie that I was supposed to be playing was enjoying the violence. And I just, I think violence is extremely complex. Mm-hmm. And yes, it can be enjoyed, but it's with a sadistic, dysfunctional... Mm-hmm. Element which has to be explored and has to be recognised.
I think you would scare me as a baddie, you know.
In one movie, what she did was she would skin her victims. I mean, you know.
You doing that?
I mean, no.
Stick to parsley.
Awful. Yeah, I'm going to stick to chopping my parsley.
It is a pleasure to see you, because it's great to see you in a good meaty British film as well.
Will you come and see the play, even though I know you don't like sitting in theatres anymore?
Okay, I'll see Death and the Maiden. And do you know what? I mean, I've seen Death and the Maiden, but I've seen the film with the Sigourney Weaver. I've never seen the actual play of it. So, yeah. Yes, all right then.
I don't want to force you out of your comfort zone, but maybe you'll make an exception just this once.
For you. Are you shaving your head like Sigourney Weaver?
Hey, no. No, I'm not. I haven't seen the film. I thought I'd wait till afterwards because I'm too intimidated.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. I mean, and it'll be different as well because, you're smaller.
I'm smaller. Mind you, my daughter is named after the character she plays in Alien.
That's right. I never forgot. Normally I do links like that. You've done them for me.
Yeah, I have huge respect for Sigourney Weaver and Ripley.
Yeah. Well, please God, you can compare notes with her one day in a big film. Yeah. Tandy, lovely to see you. Lovely to see you so at home in London's theatre with a gilded mirror and all of that, spotlights and all that. I think it's great. You'll be taking off your mask and makeup forevermore. Tandy, lovely to see you. Congratulations on Retreat too.
Thanks, my love. Thank you.
A huge thanks to Tandy Newton, and Retreat is on UK-wide release and on DVD and Blu-ray. And if you're in London and want to catch Tandy in Death and the Maiden, well, that's running at the Pinter Theatre, formerly the Comedy Theatre, on Panton Street from October the 19th to the 21st of January 2012, with an option to extend. Talking of beloved, Zan Brooks now joins me to review some of this week's other big releases. Welcome, darling.
Hello, I'm home.
Tandy Newton, you were full of praise for her last week in Retreat, so it was nice to catch up with her and realise what sort of talented actress she is. And I think is going to have another sort of second coming from that interview. I can hear that she's like back and kind of probably
she's
settling
back
into
better than ever.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Settling into the
we shall see.
But Zan, other films are out this week. We need to talk about Kevin, so we will. Contagion is out from Steven Soderbergh. The Black Power mixtape is out, so I look forward to hearing what you think about that. And The Yellow Sea from Korea, as well as Gus Van Sant's Restless. So lots to be getting on with. Anyway, let's see if we can persuade some people to go and see some of the films wherever they may be. Out there in Peterborough, you can probably go and see We Need to Talk About Kevin. Here's a clip around the dinner table. Franklin and Eva, that's Tilda Swinton and John C. Reilly, talk to their son Kevin about another accident.
So Kev, Mom had something that she wanted to tell you.
I wanted to thank you for calling the ambulance.
And
I was concerned that you might be feeling responsible.
Why's that?
Because you were supposed to be looking after her.
We just don't want you to blame yourself.
No, I don't. I mean, I never said I did.
She's going to need a glass eye, Kevin.
Zan, we saw this in Cannes early on. We both thought in our first podcast from Cannes that this would probably win something. It didn't.
It didn't. It was very early on in Cannes, and everyone got very excited about it, and it was seen as the film to beat. And then the abundance of films that then followed, maybe the jury kind of forgot about it, which was a shame, because I thought maybe Tilda Swinton should have won Best Actor. Actress for it. They call
That's
it
a very
actresses.
Guardian thing to yes, they refer to it actresses it. In the rest of the world.
She's absolutely superb, and in a kind of tailor-made role as the sort of flayed, haunted middle-class mum hiding out by the soup cans in the supermarket and being kind of attacked by the locals who know what Kevin goes on to do. Maybe Lynn Ramsey could have got Best Director. She's been away for 10 years. There's no signs of kind of ring rust on her at
Not
all.
Not at all, no. I thought there was even a shift in gear. I think she's got more narrative here than she had in Ratcatcher.
She certainly has, but that's the Lionel Shriver book that she's kind of working off, which is, I guess, a very high-concept story, even though it's written in the form of letters
it's
in the book.
It's epistolary.
Yeah.
Epistolary. All of those.
And I think maybe in other hands it could have actually turned into a kind of quite a cheesy Omen style horror movie.
Yeah, I mean, we are talking about
a bad seed movie. But I think that she keeps it honest and she keeps it strange and elusive. And it's a film that brilliantly handles its material in that it orders its flashbacks. It almost doesn't so much flashback as has this kind of liquid ebb and flow that you're carried along by without quite knowing what's going to happen, but knowing that it's not good. It immerses you in that world quite beautifully.
And I think Tilda Swinton does a wonderful job of kind of... she's obviously seeing the action. She's our point of view in a way, but she's so detached that you kind of don't quite know where the film's coming, that liquefying quality that you mentioned there.
Yeah, and she's detached, but she's also compromised. There's... maybe a bit more could have been made of that, but, she is the mother of this child that goes wrong, and she is obviously dissatisfied with her lot as a mother. She finds, particularly the early years, incredibly difficult.
Incredibly difficult, and I think that's such a strong thing to put up on screen. I can't really recall the last time I saw that. Yeah, that exactly, sort of a mother admitting failure and also not giving a damn.
And just the sheer horror of having this sudden sort of demanding little monster dropped into your life, where it seems almost quite reasonable to dislike this intruder.
Well, yeah, absolutely it is. By 5:05 this morning, I was thinking much the same thing. But he only laid waste to a couple of clown's heads this morning. But
he'll go on to bigger things.
Well, I'm worried. I was worried. I've just seen We Need to Talk About Kevin again, and I'm thinking, oh God, looking at my own child with kind of suspicion. He just smiled back, thankfully. He's not less challenging than Ezra Miller is as Kevin. It's quite important to play that role. I thought he managed it quite well, because it's one of those, you know, young kid roles that you don't want to let slip early the evil that lurks within, but you're pretty convinced by him that that not all is not well.
Yeah, he's a sort of radioactive presence in this film, and again it could have tipped into sort of hammy overacting, but he is just this sort of quiet, watchful, purely malevolent creature. Until near the end, without giving too much away, it does manage to humanize him as well.
We shall return to Lynn Ramsey and her talents a little bit later on. Zan, Contagion is out this week. It's by Steven Soderbergh, an all-star cast including Lawrence Fishburne, Kate Winslet, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Matt Damon, to name but a few, star in this film about a virus on the loose. Here's Kate Winslet contacting someone who's contracted the disease. Tells him to get off the bus.
Hi. I believe you may have had contact with Beth Emhoff last week.
Yeah, I picked her up at the airport. What's this about?
How are you feeling today?
Pretty cruddy, to be honest. Head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug.
Where are you right now?
I'm on the bus, heading to work.
I'd like you to get off immediately.
Wait, what? What's going on?
Where?
Where's the bus, Aaron?
Lake and Lindale. Can you tell me what's
Lake
going on?
Lake and Lindale. I really need you to get off that bus. Listen, it's quite possible you've come in contact with an infectious disease and that you're highly contagious. Do you understand?
Zan, Steven Soderbergh, back on form. It's never easy with him because he just does so many genres.
He goes all over the place, doesn't he? This is a sort of oiled upgrade of the 70s disaster movie, kind of darting around from various kind of global locations as this bird flu spreads and spreads and keeps on coming, and it's mutating too fast for the experts because, as Lawrence Fishburne, sort of medical expert, says, it's got, you know, nothing else to do. It starts with a bat, it goes to a pig, and then it lands slap bang on Gwyneth Paltrow, who's patient zero, who in the first sort of 10-15 minutes of the film expires on the kitchen floor.
Yeah, and I've wished that before in films.
Yeah, that she would do that. And this is a great death scene, because then she goes, they wheel her into the hospital where she has her skull sawn open by doctors, so she's got this kind of glazed look as she's lying dead there. And then just, you know, with exquisite comic timing, she just says, "Ooh." No, she doesn't.
She doesn't say that
at all.
She delivers a tearing speech, thanking Harvey Weinstein
very well,
doesn't she?
It's the role she's done born before. To play.
Poor Gwyneth. I mean, poor Gwyneth. They cut her head off in seven.
Yeah, I know.
Not to give a spoiler away, but you know, she did. They did. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, and in Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah, she was better, ironically, without it. All star cast. I mean, it just reminded me of Poseidon Adventure, Towering Inferno. But it's kind of, you know, very quick, very swiftly done. And I like this. It's one of those films that you can see those star actors coming aboard. You just need them for a week, and then they do their bit, and then they're off. It's that multiple story.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And you think, well, who's going to get it next?
Yeah.
You know, is Jude Law going to die? Is it going to be Damon? and it's, you know, it's big and cheesy, but it's thoroughly entertaining.
Isn't it? I did think so as well. And I did like the technological aspect, the science part.
Yeah, the science part is good, and it just runs like it's on kind of greased rails.
Yeah.
And just carries you through. It maybe doesn't leave that much of an impression.
Yeah, I mean, no, I think it's about stuff like, you know, personal space and who should we touch and communication in a world where, you know, it's all about the internet. But actually, you can't actually shake anyone's hand in this new world because of the virus. So I won't kiss you on this one if you don't
mind. Save it for the Christmas party.
Brilliant. The Black Power mixtape is out. This is an assemblage of Swedish documentaries found in a big vault, chronicling the rise of people like Eldridge Cleaver, Malcolm X, the brilliant Stokely Carmichael, and Angela Davis, responding to the accusation that she might just condone violence.
I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
I was bang up for this. I love all this kind of stuff. I love Gil Scott Heron songs are the first place I was introduced to all these characters in the poetry of his lines, and always was forced to then kind of investigate further. And this, I thought, was rather eye-opening.
It's a fascinating window into that time, and significantly cobbled together from Swedish TV footage, which shows that the mainstream American media at the time would not touch this topic at all,
well,
apart from, you know, to cover race riots or Attica or something like that.
I wondered if this was like somebody kind of finding a whole batch of, say, Swedish coverage of the Troubles in Northern Ireland and finding it far more useful than any mainstream BBC coverage would be.
Yeah, and there's masses of stuff here. Almost too much. That this did win an editing award at Sundance, I saw, and it's deserved in that it manages to compress all this stuff down. But at the same time, you want a little bit more insight, and you want more of a kind of through line. And although there are interviews with people now looking back on it all, you kind of want them to draw more conclusions. Yeah,
those are in voiceover, I must add.
Distances you from it a little bit more.
I actually wanted a splash of colour, a splash of kind of seeing the black people who are talking about those old black people in a slightly, I don't know, more liberated way.
Yeah, it could have been interesting. And yet, In terms of sort of the raw material, it's fascinating. And just hearing the righteous, justified rage of people like Stokely Carmichael, Huey Newton, you know, Louis Farrakhan, is still electrifying.
Absolutely. Angela Davis, too, I think.
She's great, yes.
I mean, she's gorgeous as well. That's Black Power mixtape. There's good music on that. I wanted a bit more kind of explosion of music and funk and all of that, but that would make me a cheesy director.
Turns it into the fashion statement, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And that is the thing that it does flirt with. Obviously, the thing with Black Power is that it was then adopted by kind of idiotic white middle class students.
Yeah, exactly.
So it probably does keep it honest.
Yeah, and that's what I mean, I learned a lot from it. Actually, it's one of those documentaries that is good for you. Zan, The Yellow Sea, a Korean movie about a Chinese-Korean man on the run after a botched murder.
Oh, come on.
Korean movies, I know, have got famous because of The Old Boy, that kind of, that kind of colour and sort of effects that they use, monster films already. But I'd love it when they do kind of quite down and dirty gangster pics. They get really violent.
They do. And this goes big on the kitchen knife, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
There's a lot of stabbing in this film. It's basically about a cabbie who's a gambling addict, and he's, 60 grand in the hole. And to get himself out of danger, he, as you would, he agrees to go and stab an academic for a local gangster.
We've all been to university.
We've all done it. And obviously, without giving too much away, it doesn't quite go as well.
It's not really his fault, is it, actually? He doesn't botch it as such.
No, he doesn't really botch it, but then it all explodes into sort of gang warfare and more stabbing.
The on-the-run stuff is
fantastic.
Manhunt stuff, really good.
It's fantastic. I found the first half of this better than the second half.
Yeah,
it runs so much that it starts tripping over itself.
Yeah.
And the more stabbing, the less edge.
Seem to lose a bit of Spiffer because he's not the most sympathetic lead character, and yet we spend, 2 hours in his company.
We do. Would have been nice if he'd smiled a bit, but there you go. It's possibly not the best of these grubby South Korean films, but, who cares? It's still good.
Packed a really decent punch, The Yellow Sea, for foreign films out there in Peterborough. That's probably the best you can see. So, and finally, a footnote. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. Gus Van Sant is back.
He is.
People might have seen Milk for the first time. It was on telly, I think, terrestrial TV debut the other day. This was Restless. It played in Cannes, where he has won before for Elephant. He was relegated to the Uncertain Regard sidebar this year. May I posit, this is a film about two people who meet gate-crashing funerals, starring Henry Hopper and Mia Wasikowska, who I know you're a big fan of. Mm. I think it's the worst thing he's ever done.
I think it might have even bottomed out of Finding Forrester.
Which has Miles Davis soundtrack, so that it gets a star for that.
Just about. This, I think, relegated to, in certain regard, it should have been relegated to the dustbin.
Yeah.
It's terrible. It's just bogus.
Yeah.
It's Mia Wasikowska as... you know, a cancer patient who has 3 months to live, but this doesn't stop her from, you know, she's got like chemotherapy, but that just makes her look like she's got a Gene Seberg crop. She goes ice skating and swimming and dances around in nature.
And sketches pictures of pretty little birds.
And sketches pictures of birds. And then Henry Hopper, who may well go on to be, you know, as impactful an actor as Dennis, his father, but not on the evidence of this, is like the troubled youth. And yet he's not really that troubled. He's just a little bit kooky.
He's got an imaginary Japanese friend.
He's a kamikaze pilot.
called Yoshi.
It's just, it's excruciating.
It's sort of unbearable, isn't it?
It's unbearable. It's shallow and bogus and intensely irritating.
Gus Van Sant has a history of great youth movies. I mean, not so much Finding Forrester, but, you know, Good Will Hunting, My Own Private Idaho, Elephant. I mean, he's good at this. I can't believe that he didn't stop and go, you know what? I'm too old for this shit.
It's very weird. It looks like a sort of fashion shoot for a catalogue's autumn collection. There's no heart to it at all. And it's about death. So at least make us feel something. And yet it's as deep as a puddle, this film.
Restless, useless, whatever you want. Zan, lovely to see you amid all the LFF frenzy and the frenzy of the week's releases. For all of Zan's reviews in text and video, just go to the bestest film site on the web. It's guardian.co.uk/film. Lynn Ramsey is not exactly what you'd call a prolific director, but her work so far has always suggested that she's one of the finest visual artists and filmmakers in the country. We Need to Talk About Kevin, released this week, is only her third feature, after Ratcatcher in 1999 and More Than Calla in 2002. All three films are marked by a stylistic richness and a deftness directing actresses. So when I spoke to Lynn, I put it to her that after so long away, it must be something of a personal triumph to finally have a film to show again to her many admirers.
Yeah, I mean, because in that gap, I mean, Lovely Bones, I don't want to talk about, but it's like it took about, you know, I was involved in that for about 4 years, and then I had a few personal tragedies that was really tough, and then I've been writing Kevin for a while, because it's not just a translation script. I'm not like, you could have done, you know, if you'd done a translation, literal translation for the book, it would have been a 25-hour long film, very verbose, lots of voiceover. So actually, it was one of the most difficult scripts I've ever written. It was like a jigsaw puzzle. It took intricate work, and to get it to the state it was in, it was only 87 pages, so lean beforehand. That was like writing a novel in itself.
Yeah, well, have rewritten it.
It was like smashing something. It was like starting again. So that sometimes things just take that amount of time, especially if they're non-linear and complex like this. And so it was a process of kind of ripping it up and finding the real themes of it, you know, and then sort of putting it back together again. And it was a really intricate process. A lot of the work of the film really is done in the script. I mean, the sound design and then, you know, in the editing, there's a lot of that in the script already.
Because
it was so tight on money, and it's very complicated making a film in the States where you've got UK finance, and if the dollar gets strong, you know, you're like, it was like that the week before we shot, so it was always really hairy, and it was only a 30-day shoot, so I had to really have worked out before. I mean, I probably spent 6 months.
Where did you shoot it, Lynn? People will see it, and they'll try to work out what area of America is.
I bet a couple of things, shot very little in New York, because it was, just at the beginning, and then Connecticut. The book was actually set around the Nyack area, which is the other side. It's like, you know, it's the kind of opposite side of Connecticut. If you go through up, it's like upstate New York, but they're kind of similar. You know, they've got a similar, I mean, very beautiful places. Actually, quite rich, and then you've got the sort of town centres like Stamford, which are a bit more scuzzy and stuff. So, yeah, it was interesting to see kind of outside New York as well. The landscapes and stuff.
Yeah.
You know? As a filmmaker, and it's also really good when you're a European, you know, you go over to the States and stuff, so your eyes are very fresh. I mean, everyone thinks, film vendors and stuff, you know, Paris, Texas, and I think there's a romanticism in America, but, you know, it's quite corporate in some of those places, lots of malls, and, you know, the place where she works in the travel agents, that actually was a real travel agent.
Yeah, there's quite a history of European directors going to America, and we were talking about it just the other day with Nicholas Winding Refn, who's done Drive, of course, you have a sort of distance view and a romantic view, but also a critical view, and that's all there in Kevin, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, it was surprising for me how, I mean, we found exactly the house. I couldn't have designed a set better, you know. It was, you know, because the houses are, it was very, I mean, I was looking for a kind of something that felt like where she would feel very isolated, and also it's really very big and that you couldn't hide, you know, and export a place that felt, that sort of represented in a way, like also that the family, somewhat of this, you know, the veneer of the family, a facade, you know, something where, you know, everyone's, you know, no one's really been honest, and the space kind of reflecting that.
Yeah.
And it looked like a set. It looks like, it looked like you could push a wall down, you know. It was crazy, you know. But that's great for shooting because, like, you need the space.
Yes, as you set up and move nicely. Open plan. So that you would recommend to young filmmakers, if you're shooting interiors, go for an open plan house.
Yes, I would.
Good advice.
Or any American, they're always bigger than the houses here, so it's much easier to shoot in that house, because even things like Ratcatcher, that was, you know, they were set in tenements, some of that was sets, and it's double size, you need to shoot it double size to get the angles that you need.
Right,
you
know? Yeah, no, yeah. And it still feels pretty claustrophobic.
Yeah, yeah, and just to get the shot, so you, it's funny with a set, you think, oh, it'll be, you know, you'd walk in and it'd be a representation, it's not that, and the great thing about the spaces in America, we could utilise them like that.
Yeah.
You know? So even the spaces, but the malls and all that kind of thing. I mean, we walked into the travel agents that said Inspire, you know, and big, you know, had a big sign up, you know, and everyone looked so depressed, you know. It was an insurance office, actually. So we took that little Inspire sign and kind of replicated it, a lot of the things that were already there, you know. So,
well, it goes with what your film is, because your film is sort of counterintuitive. Things shouldn't be as they are. We shouldn't be looking at mums kind of just going, oh, no, what am I going to do with this devil child?
Yeah,
so it's about that flip side of a dream that kind of goes bad.
It's fantasy in a way. It's not reality, you know, realism, you know. It's you know, Kevin's a fantastical character in a way, do you know what I mean? But it's amazing how, I was even talking to my sister-in-law last night, actually, and
has she got children?
She's got two children, and she had a really bad experience where her baby would cry the whole time, and she said she felt like throwing the baby, you know, like it was just constant. It went on for months and months and months, you know, and she was very nervous around her child. So she really related to it. It was like really strange, her seeing the film.
Yeah.
She was like, oh my God. I think, you know, I'm hoping it's pretty universal.
Yeah, it's interesting because Lionel Shriver hasn't got children. She's child-free as well, the author of the book.
I mean, I've got a very big family. I don't have kids myself, but I've got a very big Glaswegian family. We've all got kids, and, like, you know, I grew up, like, kind of, you know, practically, you know, looking after my niece a lot of the time as well, you know.
But having made Kevin, having studied the novel and your script and seen the film and lived with it so much, has it put you off? I'm not being like Jewish mum, you know, you know, are we going to see it?
Actually, someone in the audience said, oh, this is the best form of contraception.
It is.
No, I mean, I think it was ideas. I think it's it was a set of questions, you know, and a set of ideas, and that she presented, you know, and an extreme one, you know. But, and I think you do have all those thoughts, and especially older mothers. I mean, there was some, I mean, some of the things I was laughing at in the book were, she's, you know, quite vain about her body change.
And
her, you know. So, and I think these are kind of thoughts that you have that you don't really tell anyone, you know.
No, but, absolutely, you know.
Yeah, but every mother does have that fear, like, oh, what if this doesn't turn out the way I want it? You know, I mean, it might not be. You know, you don't know what you're going to get, you know.
Lynn, congratulations on being back. Can't wait to see more of your work again.
Thank you,
and love to speak to you on Film Weekly.
It's been a pleasure, thank you. And I'll see you soon, I hope.
Oh, me too.
All right, bye, Jason.
Thanks to Lynn Ramsey, and We Need to Talk About Kevin is on nationwide release from Friday, the 21st of October. And that's all for this week's show. The music we've been featuring is another fantastic score by Cliff Martinez, the score to Drive being another of his films presently on the big screen and featured on the show recently, former member of Captain Beefheart and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, no less. This is his score from Contagion. So from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye and hope you make it to a cinema wherever you are.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.